I want to begin by expressing my appreciation to the brethren here. Jim Pugh called a while ago and asked if I would be willing to speak and asked what dates I could speak. And, of course, the 30th came up. And just the fact that he called was, I'll have to admit, a thrill for me. I've always thought a lot of the congregation here and, of course, the work that takes place here ever since I became familiar with the work here at Knollwood. So I extend my appreciation to the brethren here. For those who may be visiting with us this morning, we invite you to study along with us. We're going to be studying, I think, some very important issues, some things that, particularly as we move into the coming months, I think will be a challenge to each one of us. I don't know if many of you had a chance. This morning's lesson deals really with two different issues. It deals with the issue of immodesty and the challenge that you and I are faced with in that area. And it deals with an extension of that, another part of that, and really probably it's the thing that motivates immodesty. But it deals with the things that take place in our minds as far as sex is concerned and as far as the whole issue of sex is concerned. And I would draw your attention, I don't know if you've seen one of the latest copies, but Time Magazine, in the last issue that they put out, May 24th, put out an issue called Kids, Sex, and Values. And we're going to be touching on some of the things that are commented about in this particular article as well. Something else that I would encourage you to get a hold of, if you at all possibly can. If you're familiar with Bill Bennett, there's a index of leading cultural indicators that he put out, and it is a tremendous amount of information, statistics that were taken from 1960 on to 1992 or 93. And what he puts in this are different things, and there are some things that relate to this morning's lesson as well, but just to give you some idea, he deals with statistics as far as infant mortality, teenage pregnancy, birth, abortion rates, single-parent families, children affected by divorce, marriage and divorce, suicide. I mean, he just deals with a whole list of different things. And as they relate to you and to me as God's children, it's an eye-opener. Because I think there are times when we tend to close our eyes to what's happening. And that kind of an attitude is very dangerous. All right, the thing I want to begin with in this morning's lesson is the issue of immodesty. And I deal with this issue at this particular point as far as the seasons are concerned because we're coming to a stage where the tendency is to want to peel off clothing. That's my latest find as far as a cartoon. There is a tendency on the part of individuals to shed clothing. There is the tug and the pull on you and upon me to involve ourselves in mixed public bathing. In other words, to peel clothes off down to the swimming trunks, the bathing suits, or the bikinis, and go swimming in mixed swimming company. Well, there are some dangers that go along with that. I was raised in a family where immodesty was never talked about. It wasn't dealt with. We went to the swimming pool, and we went and we got involved in mixed public swimming. So I know firsthand the dangers that exist in that, from the standpoint of a young man growing up and the things that influence a young man growing up. I can't tell you from the standpoint of a woman growing up because I'm not a woman. But I can tell you from the experience that my wife taught me when we lived together the challenges that she faced as well because of the immodesty issue. It's an issue that deals not just with women but deals with men as well. The question that sometimes is posed or asked is it really that big of a deal? Well, the answer to that question, like we talked about in the adult class this morning, the only place you and I can turn to find out for sure whether it's a big deal or not, or whether it's something that really doesn't matter, is to turn to the Scriptures and find out what is it that God says as far as modesty is concerned. Does God make it an issue, or does God leave it up to you and to me simply to say, go ahead and you determine whatever you want. What is modest for you, you determine that. Is God saying that to you and to me, or is God telling us something else? That modesty deals with something which is on a much stricter basis. That's the issue. We come down to the issue of, like we talked about this morning, authority. What authority does God give us as far as modesty or immodesty is concerned?
All right. There are two passages that I want to look at with you to begin with. The first one is in 1 Timothy chapter 2, and it begins in verse 9. Paul is addressing this letter to a young evangelist named Timothy. And involved in Timothy's instructions, he tells Timothy, there are some things that I want you to tell the women that are there. And in verses 9 and 10, he says, in like manner that women adorn themselves in modest apparel. Now remember, Paul is writing this to Timothy when? In 1960. No, it's a lot longer ago than that. But about 60-some A.D. We're talking almost 2,000 years ago. Paul wrote to Timothy about women maintaining modesty. Hasn't changed much, has it? We deal with the same issue now. We deal with the same principles now. All right, so what does Paul tell Timothy as far as modesty is concerned with women? He says, in like manner that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefastness and sobriety, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly raiment, but which becometh women professing godliness through good works. Paul gets to the heart of the matter to Timothy, and he says, the issue here is that the inner woman needs to be right with God. If the inner woman is right with God, then the outer apparel will not be that much of a challenge. The tugs and the pulls upon women to be immodest, to show their bodies, will not be that much of a pull, because if the heart is right, then the outside is simply going to follow what the mind knows to be true when you're dealing with the matter of modesty. Now, in this particular set of verses, in verses 9 and 10, Paul uses two very important words that we need to understand. The first word he uses is the word modest. The word modest comes from the Greek word kosmios, which means, as it's defined by Bynes' Dictionary on New Testament Words, orderly, well-arranged, decent, modest, in its primary sense as harmonious arrangement, dealing with the adornment. How you and I choose to decorate or adorn our bodies. Now, he says that as far as the arrangement of clothing on the body, it is to be modest or well arranged. And he says with that, the word modest, he uses another term. Take that off before it falls off. The other term he uses is the term shamefastness. It comes from the Greek word eidos, a sense of shame. Modesty is used regarding the demeanor of women in the church in 1 Timothy 2 and verse 9. Now I want to look at another verse with you that relates to shamefastness. Back in Jeremiah chapter 6 and verse 15. Here's a case back in the Old Testament. Where this term is being used, and I want you to notice how it's used in verse 15. He says, were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? Nay, they were not at all ashamed, neither could they blush. There was no shamefastness there. There was no sense of shame. Why? Why had that occurred? It had occurred here, involving the abominations or the sins that were taking place, the same way it takes place now. We lose that sense of shame. We become desensitized to it. And so we lose that sense or that ability to blush when we ought to be blushing. When the body is unclad, we tend to lose that sensitivity to it. And that's what happened here in regards to sin back in Jeremiah chapter 6 and verse 15. He says, were they ashamed when they had committed abominations? Nay, they were not at all ashamed, neither could they blush. Therefore they shall fall among them that fall. At the time that I visit them, they shall be cast down, saith the Lord. The same thing that happened back in Jeremiah 6 and 15 is happening now. If we're not careful, we can lose that same sensibility, that same ability to blush when we need to be blushing. And I think that's why Paul wrote to Timothy, and he instructed Timothy, tell these women to be careful. Maintain modesty as far as their apparel is concerned. Do it with shamefastness or shamefacedness. Use that as your standard and as your guide. Now there is a warning given to us in Proverbs chapter 7, and it begins in verse 10. In Proverbs chapter 7, beginning in verse 10, this is what happens. Now, I want you to notice particularly verse 10 as we start, because he describes here a woman who is enticing a man. And the warning here is of the young man, don't go to her house. But I want you to notice in verse 10 that he says, and behold, there met him a woman with the attire. What she was wearing, how she presented herself. A woman confronted him who was, it says here, with the attire of an harlot and subtle of heart. What does that tell you? It tells you and me that a woman can dress herself to signify something about herself. And in this case, it signified this woman was a harlot. That's what it told those who came by. And the warning here to this fella is, buddy, clear steer from her path. We want to be sure, ladies, that you're not in those shoes, that you're not playing the role of the harlot by what we're wearing, by that enticement. The body is beautiful. God made it that way. But he made it that way to have its fulfillment in a particular place, in the marriage relationship. But you see, what happens is when women maintain immodesty, and men as well, when immodesty is maintained, the result of that situation is the enticement to engage in activity that is contrary to the will of God and unrighteous and ungodly and impure. And that's what's happening here. This woman was wearing the attire of a harlot, subtle of heart. And I want you to notice how it describes the situation this guy steps into and the warning that comes to you and to me. It says in verse 11, she is loud and stubborn, her feet abide not in her house. Now is she without, now in the streets, and lieth in wait at every corner. Now, put immodesty here in what he's describing. So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him. That's what immodesty does. Sex sells. Sex flat out sells, and that's why commercials use it. You probably won't see a beer commercial on television where they don't use sex to sell the beer. If you go past the magazine racks and you look at the magazine racks where they're selling cars, what's in the front of the magazine? What are they selling? Cars. What are they using to sell it with? They're using her. That's what they're using. Or some of these women's magazines, what are they using? They're using guys in the opposite role. Those are the tools that are being used. But look at how it describes this situation. Verse 14. She says, I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows. Therefore came I forth to meet thee, diligent to seek thy face, and I have found thee. The lure is there. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works of the fine linen of Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with loves. For the goodman is not home. He has gone a long journey. He hath taken a bag of money with him and will come home at the day appointed. With her much fair speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forced him. He goeth after her straightway. Look at how it describes the man Number one, ladies, you want to be sure you're not in that situation. You don't want to be the one who is the immodest one. But number two, guys, you don't want to be the one who's led astray like this guy has been. I want you to see what happens to this fella as he goes into her bedroom. This is how it's viewed from God's viewpoint. He goeth after her straightway as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as a fowl to the correction of the stocks. Listen to what it says. Till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteth to the snare and knoweth not that it is for his life. That's how God describes that temptation. And from the man's standpoint, he's giving into it. And from the woman's standpoint, the harlot that she plays, she puts herself in that role. Verse 24 says, "Hearken unto me now, therefore, O ye children, and attend to the words of my mouth." It's a warning. Solomon is saying, heed the warning. "Let not thine heart decline to her ways, nor go astray in her paths, for she hath cast down many wounded, yea, many strong men have been slain by her." How many men have been slain by immodesty? You look at the case of David and Bathsheba. Not even dealing with the issue of whether Bathsheba was up there intentionally or not. I don't know, it doesn't say. As far as to lure somebody away. But what was the result? What was the effect of the immodesty that existed there on her part? Well, you know what happened to David and to Bathsheba's husband. You see, immodesty is a beginning point of that. It's a beginning point of that. And what happened to David and what happens to thousands of other men and women is just the result of all of that, which is why we've got to stop it, nip it in the bud. Before the summer months come, we've got to make sure that our attitude is such that I'm not going to involve myself in immodesty. I'm going to maintain that purity of how I look and how I am perceived by other people. And it ain't easy. It is not easy. Why? Because every other commercial on TV is tugging and pulling at you and I to do the opposite. There are people walking down the sidewalks, walking down the streets. When you walk into the grocery store, there are some times when you and I, as men, the men that are here, have to go... because of some of the women who are walking into that store. Because of the immodesty that exists there. So it's not easy. It is not easy being faithful to serving the God of heaven, but it is well worth it. And that's the choice that you and I have to make. All right, that warning is given to us back in Proverbs. The other two verses that are here, Hebrews 13 and verse 4, deal with the marriage relationship, and I focus on these two particular verses because it is a respecting of the right way. It is maintaining modesty and being sure that immodesty is not a part of our lives. The result of immodesty is a destruction of the marriage relationship as God intended it, a destruction of our view toward it if we're not married or if we're heading in that direction for the younger people who are here. And so Hebrews 13 verse 4 says, "Let marriage be had in honor among all, and let the bed be undefiled." Immodesty leads in the direction of allowing the bed to be defiled. Why? Because it is an enticement. That's why she is viewed as Miss Tempter. Or we could put him up there and say, Mr. Tempter. God doesn't want the bed to be defiled. He says it should be undefiled. "Let the bed be undefiled, for fornicators and adulterers God will judge." And then the passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. I read these verses because when you're talking about maintaining control as far as modesty is concerned, the reason you do that is so that you can maintain sex where it needs to be maintained. There are tugs and pulls upon you and upon me and upon our children to engage in extramarital sexual activities. If it feels good, do it. We're going to look at some statistics here that will just shock you. But that's the enticement the world gives us. And what God has given us is, you've been blessed. You and I have been blessed. And what we've been blessed with is sexual desire. And he blessed us with a place to take care of that desire. And what Paul writes to the Corinthians about in chapter 7 is how to do that. And as long as we'll stick with that, man, life can't do anything but get better. But look at the number of people who involve themselves doing the other avenue, taking the wide path that leads to destruction, and what happens in their lives. We're going to see that in just a minute. All right. 1 Corinthians 7, the first couple of verses. Apparently this question had come up. They had addressed it to Paul, and Paul responds. Now concerning the things whereof ye wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of fornications, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render unto the wife her due, and likewise also the wife unto her husband. Paul says, the sex is there as a gift. Your solution to that situation, where the desire exists, where the passion grows, if you can't maintain control of that situation, then your solution is to find a mate, to marry someone that you're going to choose to live with forever. That's how you solve that situation. Those are the blessings. In that same chapter, drop down to verses 8 and 9. He says, but I say to the unmarried and to widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. And I think Paul says that because of the current distress that they were under, the persecution. He says, in other words, he's saying, if you can, remain single. It'll be easier for you. But he goes on to say in verse 9, but if they have not continency, if you do not have the ability to control your desires, to maintain that self-control, then he says, let them marry. Why? He says, for it is better to marry than to burn. It's better to marry and resolve that challenge you've got as far as passion and as far as lust is concerned. Resolve it that way in the marriage contract than do it illicitly and contrary to the will of God and therefore burn. There's the solution to the problem. That's respecting the right way. Immodesty does not respect the right way. It does not. It entices, it tugs, and it pulls at you and I in the opposite direction of purity and godliness. And therefore becomes a challenge to you and to me to overcome it. I said we were going to talk about some statistics. As I was reading through this Time magazine, there are some things that struck me, and I want to read, and I hope this doesn't become too tedious when I try and read through this. There are some things that I saw in this that struck me. See, the action that happens is, there have been diseases, sexually transmitted diseases. All right. Syphilis, AIDS, etc. The list goes on. Now, society's reaction to that problem is, we're going to teach sex education. If you look at the Surgeon General, I believe that's the one, she's saying now that she wants sex education from kindergarten on up. The difficulty is, and this is the thing that really has struck me, and I'm sure it strikes you as well, that when the schools are involved in teaching sex education, we're going to see the difficulty of that here. When the schools are teaching sex education, there are no rights and wrongs. What they are teaching are just the facts about safe sex. Why are they teaching about safe sex? Because the action was the diseases that are there, AIDS, etc. So we're going to teach safe sex in schools. Our kids are learning how to, but they're not learning the morality, the right and the wrong. Why not? Because you see, if you teach them the right and the wrong, you're imposing your morality. Religion steps into the picture. You don't have separation of church and state. You can't do that being supported by federal monies. So morality doesn't enter the picture. When it does, there are a bunch of people who stand up and say, ha, you're pushing your religion. So we've got sex education being taught with no moral standard. The result?
Sexual activity among teens is increasing. The question was posed, have you ever had sexual intercourse of 13 and 15 year olds? Of that group, 19% said yes. 19% said yes. My son is 15. That's kids that are 2 years younger than he is. Of those just 2 years older, 16 to 17, 55% said yes. Our kids are learning how. Our kids are learning how. Now I want to read you some things that this article talks about and some of the problems. The title of this article, if you noticed on the front cover, Kids, Sex, and Values. Now, this is the message that our kids are getting. Just do it. Just say no. Just wear a condom. What's a kid supposed to think? Those are the questions. Here's part of the problems. He says there is a force that is easiest to blame and hardest to measure. The saturation of American popular culture with sexual messages, themes, images, exhortations. Teenagers typically watch 5 hours of television a day. And from the other statistics that I've run across, that's low. 5 hours of television a day, which in a year means they have seen nearly 14,000 sexual encounters, according to the Center for Population Options. Kids are seeing a world in which everything is sensual and physical. Immodesty. Sex sells. Everything is sensual and physical, says Dr. Richard Ratner, who this week takes office as president of the American Society for Adolescent Psychiatry. Even in this era of feminism, rap songs preach, I can't even read you what this rap song says. Everything is more explicit. It's the difference between wearing a bathing suit and walking around nude, is what this man says. The content of popular culture has been a favorite target among politicians caught up in the cultural wars, but kids themselves have their own criticisms of what they see. Many recoil at the sexual pressures they feel from Calvin Klein ads, MTV, heavy breathing movies, all the icy, staged or oddball sex they see in books by Madonna and rock videos. If you turn on TV, there's a woman taking off her clothes, says Marcela Avila, a senior at Santa Monica High, who was among a group of students who sat down with Time's Jim Wellworth to discuss the sexual landscape they face. It makes you doubt yourself. Am I okay? You put yourself down. I'll never be able to satisfy a guy, her classmate Elizabeth Young agrees. The media doesn't make it seem like it's really about love, she says. Nowadays, sexuality is the way you look. Why? Because sex sells. It's the way you look, the way you wear your hair. It's all physical, not what's inside you. And isn't that what Paul wrote to Timothy? Focus on the inner woman, not just the outward woman. They both play a role. There's another part of this I wanted to read. Here it is. It says, just do it, just say no, just wear a condom. When it comes to sex, the message to America's kids is confused and confusing. Now, there's a reason for that confusion. The moral standard society once generally accepted, or at least paid lip service to, fell victim to a sexual revolution and a medical tragedy. A decade marked by fear of AIDS and furor over society's values made it hard to agree on the ethical issues and emotional context that used to be part of learning about sex. In other words, morality is no longer in the picture. It's not allowed to be. It's not allowed to be. Because a few vocal people have stood up and says, no, you're enforcing your religion. And so what do we have? We have those kind of percentages of kids being involved in sexual activity. Those on the right react to condom giveaways and gay curriculums and throbbing MTV videos as signs of moral breakdown. Those on the left dismissed such concerns as the rantings of religious zealots and shunned almost any discussion of sexual restraint as being reactionary or, worse yet, unsophisticated. Family values became a polarizing phrase. In one sense, the arrival of AIDS in the American psyche a decade ago ended the debate over sex education. Health experts were clear about the crisis. By the time they are 20, 3/4 of young Americans have had sex. 1/4 of teens contract some venereal disease each year. About 20% of all AIDS patients are under 30, but because the incubation period is 8 years or more, the CDC believes a large proportion were infected by HIV as teenagers. But as parents and educators watch the fallout from nearly a decade of lessons geared to disaster prevention, here is a diagram, and this is some of the antics that are used. Here's a diagram of the female anatomy. This is how you put on a condom. He says there are signs that this bloodless approach to learning about sex doesn't work. Kids are continuing to try sex at an even more tender age. More than a third of 15-year-old boys have had sexual intercourse, as have had 27% of 15-year-old girls, up from 90% in 1982. Among sexually active teenage girls, 61% have had multiple partners, up from 38% in 1971. Among boys, incidents like the score-keeping Spur Posse gang in California and the sexual assault conviction of the Glen Ridge, New Jersey jock stars suggest that whatever is being taught responsible sexuality isn't being learned. Took us a while to catch on. All right. Some more statistics. And this gets to the solution. Not the bottom of this chart. The question was asked, where have you learned the most about sex? 13 to 15-year-olds are on the left, 16 and 17-year-olds are on the right. Of the 13 to 15-year-olds, 30% of those kids said they learned the most about sex from their parents. Of 16 and 17-year-olds, 22% said they learned the most about sex from their parents. But I want you to look at where else these kids are learning. 26% of the 13 to 15-year-olds said they learned most about sex from their friends. 37% of the 16 and 17-year-olds said they learned it from their friends. 26% of the 13 to 15-year-olds said they learned it from school. What are they getting from school? They're getting how-tos. Why? Safe sex. What are we preventing? Sexual diseases. Morality? No, shut up about morality. We just want to teach safe sex. 15% of those 16 and 17-year-olds said they learned most they know about sex in school, and 15% and 18% of the kids in both classes said that they learned it from entertainment. Movies, etc. What does that last statistic tell you? And this brings us back to immodesty. What does that tell you as a child of God? And if you're here this morning and you're not a child of God, you're not a Christian, what's it tell you?
Points you and I at a solution to the problem.
The solution to the problem is you and I have got to get off our duffs and start talking and start communicating. The solution to the problem is to talk to our kids, because I'll tell you what, if you leave morality to the schools, if you leave morality to the kids that they're running around with, if you leave morality to entertainment, you've lost them. You and I have lost them because either they're not getting morality or the morality that they're getting is dangerous. Listen to this. Schools are attempting to fill in where parents have failed, but it has been hard for educators over these past few years to know what to teach when society itself cannot agree on a direction. Absent any agreement over what is proper sexual conduct, teachers can be left reciting word for word the approved text on homosexuality or abortion. The typical sex ed curriculum is markedly... let me jump on to Joyce Elders, or Jocelyn. Jocelyn Elders, President Clinton's nominee for Surgeon General, is leading the fight for a more comprehensive approach from kindergarten through 12th grade. As head of the Arkansas Health Department, she was one of the country's most outspoken advocates of wide-range sex education. You see, the danger in this is that sex education from the standpoint of the public school system is homosexuality, lesbianism, abortion. I mean, the avenues go on and on. Why? Because there is no morality in the picture, which challenges you and I as God's children and challenges our children. If you and I aren't teaching them, who is? They are. She says, we've spent all our time fighting each other about whose values we should be teaching our kids, she complains. We've allowed the right to make decisions about our children for the last 100 years. And all it has brought us, or all it has bought us, is the highest abortion rate, the highest non-marital birth rate, and the highest pregnancy rate in the industrialized world. But Elders is no advocate of values-free instruction. Proper sex education, she says, would be teaching kids how to develop relationships and about the consequences of their behavior. Kids can't say no if they don't first learn how to feel good about themselves. My question here is that when this individual gets involved in placing values, whose values is it? What if her values are the values of homosexuality and lesbianism? And I'm telling you, they're taught. They are taught in the schools. What if her values are the values of abortion? What if her values are the values of a Dr. Kevorkian? What if those are the values? Then what? Well, I'll tell you what it says. It says that the solution to our problem that we face as far as immodesty is concerned and as far as all the things that result from that and come from that, the solution to that problem God gave us a long, long time ago. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 6. In chapter 5, God gave a solution to this very problem, as it is a solution for every problem. In verse 5, it says, "And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. Never close your mouth about the word and the will of God. If you don't teach it, it ain't going to get taught. Your children will not learn it. And on top of that, if you and I don't live it, they won't learn it either, no matter how much you and I talk. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes, and thou shalt write them upon the posts of thine house and on thy gates." Verse 17 says, "You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord thy God and his testimonies and his statutes which he hath commanded thee." Do his will. Serve him. Teach it. Teach it. Teach it. You and I do not have a choice. The age of letting someone else teach modesty. I'll set that as a standard. The age of letting someone else teach my children about sex because I'm embarrassed about it is gone, brethren. It is gone. You and I need to open the scriptures, let God's definition of what morality is be our standard, and teach it, teach it, teach it, and live it. Because if you and I don't, we're going to miss the boat as far as our own souls and the souls of our kids. I think that's the point that Moses is making when he wrote Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 5 through 9. The other passage in Ephesians chapter 6, particularly verse 4, Verses 1 through 3 talk about the responsibility of the kids to obey your mother and your father. Verse 4 says, dads, your responsibility is to raise your children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. It's the same thing that Moses wrote to the Israelites. Spend time every day communicating to your kids what the will of God is. When you're driving your car, you're going to the grocery store, talk, communicate. When they get home from school, talk, communicate. When they come in from the ball game, talk, communicate. About honesty, about integrity, about the work ethic, about biblical principles, about modesty, about immodesty. Teach them what the Word of God says. Man, that is so, so important. If we don't, well, we've seen what happens when we don't. The statistics are screaming out loud to you and to me as parents, and to you and to me as far as our involvement in whatever the community is that we exist. The church here is no different than the church in Brookville. We face the same challenges you do as far as immodesty is concerned. And I encourage you as strong as I possibly can to make sure that God's guideline is the guideline that you're using to serve it. If you're here this morning and you are not a member of the body of Christ, the plea that God makes throughout the scriptures is, turn your life over to Him. Set you off the throne of your life and put Jesus Christ where He belongs. There's only one way to do it, and that's to do it based upon the plan that He has laid out. If you're here this morning and you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, you know, we went through Brookville and took a survey, and we asked people, do you believe in Jesus Christ? I think I might have had one person of the hundreds that we talked to said, no. Most people have the beginning right. They believe in Jesus Christ. John 8, verse 24 says, you and I can't be acceptable to God unless we do. So if you're here this morning and you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, there's only a few more steps you need to take to become a Christian. Number two is you've got to be willing to acknowledge that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He is your Lord and your Master. Matthew 10, verse 32. You confess Him before men, He'll confess you before His Father. And the third thing you need to do is to be willing to repent and turn away from sin. Whatever that sin might be. Maybe it has been immodesty. Maybe it has been something involved in sex or something like that. But God is pleading with you to turn away from whatever that is and to turn to serve Him based upon His will. Repent of whatever the sin is. And to be baptized into the Son of God, Jesus Christ. Mark 16, 15, and 16, and a host of other verses. What happens? When you do that, your sins are washed away. They are remitted by the blood of Christ. If you're here this morning and you are not a child of God, then God is pleading with you to obey the gospel and be baptized into Christ. The water is here. The water is ready. The preparations are all ready. The question now is, are you willing? The ball is in your court. And God is asking you to come while we stand and while we sing.